From New England Public Radio in Springfield, Massachusetts, this is NEPR News Now. Stories you really should not miss. Thanks for listening. I'm Sam Hudzik. I edit the local news here at New England Public Radio. On this episode, Worcester is making a serious pitch to be the new home of the Boston Red Sox top minor league team. But the Paw Sox of Pawtucket may have other plans.
People in Rhode Island are mindful of Worcester, but Montreal is also seen as a strong potential rival for the Paw Sox.
Well, you know, Montreal had the Expos. That went really well. Then we hear the story of a husband and wife who, decades ago, covered up the state motto of New Hampshire on their license plates. Live free or die?
The police officer came to me and says, I have to give you a citation because you're covering up the motto. I says, well, it's been a long time. I've been waiting for you.
That case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they'll be mentioned often in a case before the court this fall. And we hear from a Hartford resident who this summer took his son to the over-budget, long-delayed Dunkin' Donuts park.
I pushed aside my feelings of hypocrisy and took him out to the old ball game. And I have to admit, there's just nothing like it.
But Jamil Raglan says it's complicated. All that's just ahead on NEPR News Now. But first, tens of thousands of people have left Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria devastated the island. One of the prime destinations is Holyoke, Massachusetts, where a nonprofit is connecting Puerto Ricans with government services. WBUR's Simone Rios introduces us to one young family that's trying to get its feet on the ground.
Well, what are you doing with me now?
7 weeks ago, Hurricane Maria roared through the center of Puerto Rico. Winds battered the palm leaves and rain poured over the houses in the town of Barrancas. The moment brought terror to Germán Santini, who captured the storm on video from inside his home. Santini emerged the next day to see a town that looked like it had been hit by airstrikes.
All the trees have fallen. You get the urge to cry. You don't feel like doing anything, seeing everything destroyed. Puerto Rico is going to take a long time to recover from this.
For Santini, the worst part was not being able to communicate with his wife, who was in Holyoke in the third trimester of her pregnancy.
2 weeks went by, and I didn't know how she was doing. I couldn't tell her that I was okay either.
On October 16th, a few days after Santini arrived on a packed flight from San Juan, his son Yedriel was born in Holyoke. The parents were visibly stressed. They had nowhere to go after leaving the hospital. Before the hurricane, the plan had been for the whole family to move to Puerto Rico, but they decided they couldn't bring a newborn to a place with no electricity and no running water. Santini's wife, Soli Maria Alicea, says it was a choice between two bad options.
Over there, I have my family, and he had his job. And now we can't return because we don't have anywhere to go. Here, at least we can get assistance. In Puerto Rico, there is no assistance now.
Enlace está aquí, pero sin ustedes no somos nada. Y otra vez, bienvenidos a esta ciudad. Suerte.
Betty Medina Lichtenstein heads Enlace de Familias in Holyoke. The state has designated Enlace as the city's welcome center for new arrivals. Medina says each week they're receiving more than 60 families from Puerto Rico. Medina bounces from client to client, trying to match people's needs with the respective services. The task is massive, and Medina is short-staffed.
I need to be able to do a follow-up with families. Like, you know, if somebody was here that needed daycare, I don't have anybody here that's daycare. How about vet services, child support, like someone raised, workman's comp? I don't have anything of that here. And so that we need to be able to have case managers that then are able to do that follow-up.
When Hurricane Maria hit, Puerto Rico was already in the eye of a storm. A decade-long recession that has left the island bankrupt with tens of billions in debt. The hurricane turned a steady flow of emigration into a raging flood. Researchers from the City University of New York estimate more than 200,000 people could flee Puerto Rico each year, as many as 14,000 to Massachusetts. A month and a half after the hurricane, state officials say more than 1,000 have already sought help. Medina says she sees a generational divide among those that plan to stay and those who will return.
It's mostly the elders that want to go back. The young people are like, I'm done with that, unless they own property there. And there isn't a lot of young people that own, and I'm saying more about millennium age. But the elders are planning on going back.
Germán Santini tries out the faucet and stove in his family's temporary home in Greenfield, 30 miles north of Holyoke. The triple-decker apartment was found by the nonprofit Enlace and belongs to the State Department of Housing.
I'm more at peace now that we have a place to stay and a place to cook, and we're able to provide a stable home for the baby.
Santini is grateful, but he says he already misses life on the island.
In Puerto Rico, you know a lot of people, and a lot of people know you. It's very different here. Over there, when you're walking somewhere, somebody stops to give you a lift. Over here, no. Here, you take the bus.
But Santini says his priority now is to provide stability for his family, and it's here in Massachusetts that he can make that happen. Now, he needs to get a job, learn to speak English, and find a permanent place for his family to call home. For New England Public Radio, I'm Simon Rios.
From Holyoke to Worcester, where the city is sharpening its bid to lure the Pawtucket Red Sox to central Massachusetts. The Pawsox are the AAA affiliate of the Boston Red Sox. The Telegram and Gazette newspaper reports nearly 20 other locations have also pitched redevelopment proposals to the team. But there are some Rhode Islanders who want to keep them in the Ocean State. Ian Donis has been covering all of this for Rhode Island Public Radio. New England Public Radio's Carrie Healy asked Ian why the Pawsox are considering a move.
Well, the Pawsox home at McCoy Stadium in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, is considered antiquated. That's been in use since the mid-20th century. It was updated in the 1990s. But right now, the Pawsox say the cost of bringing it up to standard would be about $40 million, which would be a big chunk of creating a new, more desirable ballpark.
So that's kind of the backstory. And since you're a political reporter, what are the latest political developments in this saga? Can you catch us up with what's coming out of Rhode Island?
Sure. Well, the Pawsox came back earlier this year with a proposal to move less than a mile away from their current site in Pawtucket to a site near downtown Pawtucket. And the Pawsox say their $84 million stadium, if it goes ahead, would catalyze economic development. But the public in Rhode Island has been very skeptical about the idea. Many people remember the failure of 38 Studios owned by former Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling. He had a video game company that got some state money and it went bankrupt. Rhode Island taxpayers were left holding the bag, so to speak, and has made people skeptical about using public dollars for private industry. And it's really difficult to tell right now whether or not this proposal is going to go ahead. There's more support for it in the Rhode Island Senate than in the Rhode Island House.
Meanwhile, Worcester, Massachusetts, has hired two top consultants to assist in luring the team to the WU. That would move them, what, about 40 miles north and west of where they are now. Is Pawtucket feeling legitimately threatened by Worcester?
It depends who you ask. The people who love the Pawsox and most want the Pawsox to stay in Rhode Island feel like the longer this plays out, the greater the risk that the Pawsox could wind up going somewhere else. And people in Rhode Island are mindful of Worcester, but Montreal is also seen as a strong potential rival for the Pawsox. Montreal still has a former Major League Baseball park that could kind of be retrofitted, at least in the short term, to host a minor league team. And there's a real strong passion for baseball in Montreal. But people who are more skeptical really question whether there's any other community, Worcester, Montreal, or any other, that would offer tens of millions of dollars in public borrowing to help attract the team, as is being considered in Rhode Island.
So what are the actual dates that these decisions have to be made by?
Well, the Paw Sox say they have just a couple of seasons left at McCoy Stadium, their current home. They want to resolve this issue as soon as possible. But because of the Rhode Island experience of having been burned with 38 studios, that has kind of slowed down the process. And it seems like the Paw Sox really do want to stay in Rhode Island, although one of their top executives, Larry Lucchese, Kino, has certainly expressed his frustration about dealing with Rhode Island's political scene. And it's possible we may see some resolution in the new legislative session next year, but it's really difficult to predict how this is going to play out right now.
Ian Donis, the political reporter at Rhode Island Public Radio, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This fall, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments in a free speech case out of Colorado, where a baker refused to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. The baker's attorneys say they're resting their argument on a precedent set decades ago in New Hampshire. New Hampshire Public Radio's Lauren Chulgen has the story.
Live free or die for many New Hampshire people is just part of the culture of living here. It's on T-shirts, it's a good New Hampshire joke punchline, it's constantly quoted in political speeches. But even though we may hear it all the time, most of us don't really think too much about it. But George and Maxine Maynard are different.
It's Lauren.
Yeah, it is. No, it's afternoon. No.
No, I said it's Lauren.
The Maynards have what you might call a complicated relationship with Live Free or Die. They're in their mid-80s now. They shuffle around their one-story home in Connecticut, where they keep tabs on their neighbors and read the Bible every day. The Maynards are deeply religious.
Okay, Daniel, D-A-N.
Take George's email address, for example. It's Daniel_2_44, a Bible verse he will happily explain to you.
As God's promised, he's going to crush all the governments of the world, and his government is going to rule by his son, Jesus Christ. So that's my email.
And the Maynards' faith is central to this story and their relationship to Live Free or Die. George calls himself a Jehovah's Witness, even though he was kicked out or disfellowshipped in 1966. I couldn't confirm why this happened. George says some other witnesses didn't like him, so they falsely accused him of defrauding other members. Whatever happened, George hasn't been allowed in a Kingdom Hall since, but not for lack of trying.
When we moved up to New Hampshire, here again, I tried to attend meetings, and they wouldn't let me. So they would treat me like a leper.
So here you had George Maynard, deeply religious, disfellowshipped, feeling like he didn't have the right to practice his own religion. And he was moving to New Hampshire, a state with Live Free or Die on its license plates. The motto didn't stand a chance.
I wasn't free.
To the Maynards, having Live Free or Die stuck on their car was like advertising a way of life they didn't subscribe to. They didn't feel free, and they believe God will grant them everlasting life. So George covered up the motto with a strip of red electrical tape. And with that bit of tape, battle lines were drawn between the Maynards and the state of New Hampshire. The first encounter took place in a Lebanon parking lot in 1974.
We were shopping one night, and the police officer came to me and says, "I have to give you a citation because you're covering up the motto." I says, "Well, it's been a long time. I've been waiting for you."
New Hampshire law prohibited residents from altering their state plates, so George was fined $25. A judge later suspended it, pending good behavior. But George didn't remove the tape. He went a step further.
It wasn't too long after that, the same officer stopped me again.
Neil Woolley was the Lebanon police chief back then.
Only this time they'd taken a pair of cutting shears or something and physically cut the words right out of the plate.
George ended up getting 3 tickets.
But when the laws of man conflict with God...
He recorded himself fighting those tickets in district court. And listening to this cassette tape, it's clear that even all these years later, George's passion against the motto has not changed. When he played it for me, he mouthed the words along with his younger self, as if the arguments were imprinted in his brain.
Live free or die is against my teaching and my belief, because life is more valuable than freedom to me.
George told the judge he refused to pay the fines, and he was sentenced to 15 days in jail.
They treated me pretty nice. It was comfortable. It wasn't.
I had to use somebody else's car to go and visit him.
Oh, right, because you didn't have any license plates.
No, she didn't have it. She didn't.
All the way to Grafton County. That was quite a trip.
George lost his job because of the jail time, and the Maynards really struggled to get by. But then they got a big phone call from the ACLU, They helped take the Maynards case to the New Hampshire Supreme Court. And so a legal fight began over what free really meant in the state of New Hampshire.
Yeah, it was a good trial.
Here's Neil Woolley again. As police chief, he was named in the lawsuit, Woolley versus Maynard.
We worked with the way the law was written at the time. But the Supreme Court found that the Maynards had the right based on their beliefs. So consequently, we lost. It was like no big deal.
And that would have been the end of it. Big victory for the Maynards. They could tape their plates as they pleased. And Woolley was clearly fine with the decision. No big deal. Except the ruling was a big deal in the New Hampshire State House.
Well, it was a very interesting time. The political landscape was quite different than it is now.
This is Tom Rath. He was a prosecutor in the Attorney General's office in the 1970s when this all went down. And he's been a fixture in state politics since.
There was a kind of an insurgent part of the Republican Party from the far right that had taken over with the election of Meldrum Thompson.
Governor Meldrum Thompson. Next to Woolley and the Maynards, he should really also have top billing in this story. There are endless anecdotes that illustrate Thompson's unique brand of conservatism. He was very anti-tax. He thought the National Guard should have nuclear weapons. And he was devoted to live free or die. He talks about it in this old educational video.
This was a sentiment of those who fought the Revolutionary War. And I think that it's imperative that we understand that our liberty came to us by those who are willing to make that kind of sacrifice for it.
Thompson says it was his idea before he was governor to put the motto on license plates.
I don't know of any more prominent place to carry a message than right on the license plate. That's the best billboard of all.
So while George Maynard saw Live Free or Die as an affront to his deeply held religious beliefs, Thompson saw the motto as a vital declaration of patriotism. So the governor ordered the attorney general to take the case to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Maynards were really surprised by this.
Yeah, I was.
I was a little bit surprised, yeah. I didn't think they were going to go that far, but I said, hey.
As in, hey, bring it on.
We'll hear arguments next in 75-14-53, Woolley against Maynard.
The AG's office argued that just because a car displays the motto doesn't automatically mean the driver believes in it. But in the end, the Supreme Court disagreed. And in a 6-3 decision, the court ruled it was against the Constitution to force citizens to use private property as a, quote, mobile billboard for the state's ideological message.
The judgment of the United States District Court for the District of New Hampshire is affirmed.
And that, finally, would have been the end of all that. But much to the surprise of everyone involved, Woolley versus Maynard has become one of the most important First Amendment cases in history. Next month, for example, the Supreme Court will hear the case of a Colorado baker who says he shouldn't be forced to bake wedding cake for a same-sex couple because it's against his religious beliefs. One of the baker's attorneys, Jeremy Tedesco, calls the Maynard's victory crucial to their case.
It's one of those just primary cases that if you are battling as a plaintiff against the government coercing you or compelling you to engage in expression you don't want to engage in, Woolley versus Maynard is one of your go-to cases. So thank you, New Hampshire.
While the case of Woolley versus Maynard may be forever linked to New Hampshire, the Maynards actually left the state long ago for Connecticut. And in case you were wondering, yes, they also covered up Connecticut's motto, the Constitution State, on their license plates.
It's so a policeman tried to give me a ticket. It's so what they did is said, nah, we better not fool around with this guy. So they dropped it.
And with that, at least for a moment, the Maynards felt free. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Lauren Chulgen.
Baseball season wrapped up earlier this month with that home run-packed World Series that caught the attention of fans from L.A. to Houston and even Hartford. Connecticut's capital city celebrated minor league baseball's return this past season. Commentator and Hartford resident Jamil Ragland says there are dozens of other projects more worthy of public money. So really enjoying himself at a game gave him pause, briefly.
My 10-year-old son Gabriel loves baseball. When I received free tickets to a game at Dunkin' Donuts Stadium this May, I pushed aside my feelings of hypocrisy and took him out to the old ball game. And I have to admit, there's just nothing like it. Take outfielder Dylan Thomas's 3-run shot for the Yard Goats in the bottom of the 6th inning. The home crowd erupted. It was so much fun. I loved hearing the crack of the bat connecting with the ball, and my son yelling, "Wow!" as he watched it sail through the air. We laughed as the Dunkin' Donuts mascots raced each other between innings. Gabriel wanted the donut to win, but the coffee culotta edged him out. We talked about the excellently named player Carell Prime. We had a blast. As day turned to evening, Gabriel was getting tired. The Yard Goats were up 6-2, so we agreed to walk home. Within 2 blocks of the stadium, we passed an open field overgrown with grass and weeds. The only thing in it is a large wooden cross covered with pictures and remembrances. 41-year-old Angelo Milardo was found dead there in August of 2016. It's a weird thing, a cross in a field. The first time I walked by it, I was drawn to learn more about this addition to my neighborhood, so I walked into the field to take a closer look. That's how I learned the man's name, from his picture in the center of the cross. When I got home, I searched for him online. There was almost nothing. No mention of him by name in the Current, for instance, just a funeral home's obituary. A monument to a largely forgotten man. It's fitting as the first thing you see when you enter the north end of Hartford. It screams, "This is a place everyone but those of us who live here seems to have forgotten about." Baseball's a complicated game. The ideas are simple enough. Throw the ball, hit the ball, catch the ball. Then you start asking questions. How should you throw the ball? Where? How hard should you hit it? The more questions you ask, the more complex the game becomes. The idea of enjoying a baseball game in a sparkly new stadium in downtown Hartford is simple enough, too. As long as you don't ask any questions, that's when things become complicated.
Jameel Ragland is a writer who works and lives in Hartford. All right, that's all I got for you today. This podcast is produced by New England Public Radio, a listener-supported public media company that brings you news and music and NEPR.net. You can find much more news there, and while you're visiting, consider making a contribution to New England Public Radio. Just click that orange donate button at the top of the screen. Thanks so much for listening, and if you liked what you heard, please leave a review for NEPR News Now. Until next time.